Welcome to Compromising Positions. I'm Leanne Potter, cyber anthropologist and head of security operations for a major retailer.
And I'm Jeff Watkins, a cybersecurity enthusiast and CTO for a major tech consultancy. Together, we're the tech podcast that asks non-cybersecurity professionals what we in the industry can do to make their lives easier.
And help make our organisations more prepared to face ever-changing human-centric cyber threats.
This week, we return to our conversation with Beck McKeown. Beck is a chartered psychologist with extensive experience in carrying out applied research for organisations, including the UK Ministry of Defence. She's also the founder and director of Mind Science, an independent organisation that works with cybersecurity professionals.
Last episode, we ended by talking about how cyber criminals leverage the fight or flight response and get you to do things you wouldn't normally do, like share bank details, through what we now know is called the amygdala hijack. Beck gave us some great advice on how we can retrain ourselves not to be so reactive and hopefully stop ourselves from doing something rash.
In this episode, awareness does not equal behavioural change, rethinking cybersecurity training. We're going to build upon what Beck discussed last week, a cyber psychology 101 if you will, and see how we practically apply key psychological concepts like cognitive agility, convergent and divergent thinking and metacognitive skills to things like tabletop exercises and security awareness training.
I've been really looking forward to this because last week I learned so much, and if you haven't already, do check out the previous episode.
Yeah, we love this chat and we think you will do too. So sit back and enjoy part two of our interview with Beck McKeown.
When you were talking just then, I immediately thought Beck would be a really good person to have during tabletop simulations and things like that. And I'm probably actually a really good person to have during an actual incident going ahead. Can you walk me through what, from your experience as a psychologist, working in this space, understanding high stress environments, but within the context of like a sort of cybersecurity incident, what's gold standard look like, I guess, for a cybersecurity team?
Yeah, there is, as we've just been talking about with training, it's going to be a gold standard. It's going to be different for everybody because everybody's context is different and every situation is different. You can't train for every situation, but my research has taught me to believe you can train for any situation. So it's about having the skills
like
to be able to question what's in front of you. Cognitive agility is something that I've done a lot of research into, and it's the ability to take that pause that we were just talking about there and to start critically evaluating what's in front of you. So what is the source of your information? Have we got information from more than one source? Somebody else from a different group will have a different view on that information. So in military we call it red teaming. I think the same phrase in cyber security. Decision testing. There's a whole ton of stuff that you can put in place, and I think that it's having that ability to flex. So when do I pick up the playbook and follow that? And when do I know that actually this situation is not going to be helped by the playbook? I have to then become creative. Then you've got a whole other set of thinking skills there. It's about convergent and divergent thinking. And to be fair, I could go on about this for hours, so I probably won't go down that route.
If you could explain convergent, divergent thinking first.
Yeah, okay. Well, convergent thinking is when you tend to do is you focus down, you're focusing down. So here's the problem. We're thinking about the solution and we're narrowing down about all of the benefits and the disadvantages until we come to a thing and then we act on it. So that's convergent because we're converging down on one particular decision. Now, a divergent thinker will do it exactly the opposite way. So instead of coming up with one thing, narrowing down to one thing, they'll come up with lots of different options. We could do this, we could do that, we could do A, B, C, D, E, F, Z, H, J, K. Right. Now then, once we've done that, that's the creativity, then you can converge down from that. But instead of just going down on one option, you're there creating lots of different options. And you might even bring parts from each of those different options to create something new. So the ability to move from convergent to divergent thinking and to know when to do that is basically what agile thinking is all about. And that, for me, is how you train for every situation without training for any particular situation, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
No, it totally does.
Because you've got the cognitive, the thinking side of things, but you've also got the people side of things. Because the other thing that we tend to do is we like people who think like us. We've all been in a meeting where somebody says something and you look around the room and everybody's rolling their eyes because this person is the one person that always chucks a spanner in the works. Do you know what? Listen to that person. And Christian said this the other day, listen to the people who are complaining because they've got something to tell you. They're going to tell you where the problems are in your system. But also having those challenges to that groupthink means that you get that divergence of thought again. It is so easy for me to say it. It is so difficult to do, particularly if you're working in a team that's very bonded. Everybody knows each other really well. We all think very similarly. And so actually building a diverse team is something you'll hear a lot of people say. It's not easy to do. But if you can, then that's where the beauty of this cognitive agility comes in. So it's about the thinking side of things. It's about building relationships. But to do both of those things, it's about self-awareness. The three components to it. But for me, that's, you can tell I'm just so excited about this. It's something that I did a lot of research into when I was looking at how people who are successful in cross-cultural environments, how do they think, what skills do they have, and how do they develop them? Because that's the answer to being able to work across many situations and not just keep relying on experience of one particular way of working and apply that blindfold to everything.
To me, what I find interesting about that research you've just mentioned there is it kind of flies in the face of, we work in heuristics because it's easy. You know, we draw upon past experiences. We do things based on rote, based on ritual, because otherwise the cognitive load would be too much. But I can definitely see how, and normally we laud that as a good thing, but I can definitely see how in certain circumstances, yes. So for example, during a tabletop exercise or, heavens forbid, an actual incident, and you get out that dusty playbook and you start running through it, you know, knowing we've trained, we've done this before, we've got a bit of muscle memory, that's a positive thing. But like you say, having that mental agility to be able to say this is off script, and we can move towards that. And it kind of makes me think of, you know, when you do speak to like customer services, for example, and they're brilliant when they've got something on script, but then when they don't have the autonomy, when something comes off script to kind of help you, and you get frustrated with that. And that learning that you've mentioned there is going to be so key. So how would people encourage in cybersecurity teams to embrace that learning? It's not an easy thing to me, by the sounds of it, to flexing that muscle a little differently.
It is, yeah, but I think it's not something that you're ever going to learn from going on a training course. And this is kind of really why I went to work with Immersive Labs, because they get micro learning and little nibbles and taking it back to the workplace. And that's how adults learn. So for me, it's about learning about these things. You can have knowledge about it. I could teach you lots of different techniques that you can use, and that's going to be great. But it's only when you get back into the workplace and you start to use them, and it might not necessarily be an emergency situation, it might just be in an ordinary decision-making situation, but you start to use them, then we go through and actually we look back on it and review, right, so what happened here? How did it go? Did it go well for you? What did you learn from that? What did you do differently that made it go well as a result of the thing that you learned? What didn't work quite so well? What do you think happened there? Why do you think that happened? What would you do next time? And that is the most painful bit, to be honest. I used to hate having to do reflective learning. But if you stick with it, you do it automatically. So you start to learn all the time. And then each time you learn something new, you go back and it builds up your worldview. Because you're learning by mistakes, you're learning by doing. And then each time you go around that learning loop, you're moving up from novice to competent, expert, mastery. You know, so you become better and better and better at learning that subject the more that you do it. There is a phrase, slow learning, quick results, or something like that. I will have to look it up. But you're learning very slowly, but actually your learning is being put into action the minute you learn it. It's not like going on a training course. You start to use it 2 months after you went on the course, by which time you've forgotten some of it anyway. So it's about the way you learn, not just what you actually learn.
Feels like the SQS, so I've been involved recently with design for an H&D program in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And one of the big things they're pushing now, and it's really hard to quantify, is meta skills. And it sounds like what you're talking about there is meta skills. It's not just learn how to deal with this one thing. It's like learning actual life skills that make you a more rounded person.
Yep. And metacognitive skills is something else that's knowing what you know. And I wonder if that's what they're getting at there as well. And it is, I read an interesting piece of research that said that when you're coming out of university, you're equipped with the technical skills you need, but you're not equipped to deal with the workplace. You don't know how the workplace works. You don't understand culture, about how to behave in the workplace, about the nature of relationships in the workplace. So I think it's becoming more common for people to recognise that soft skills, even though I hate calling it that, it's a phrase that most people recognise. Soft skills are so important, but I think that's kind of even been knocked out during schools now. It's all about STEM, English, SAT scores, exam results, and I don't think you can even take psychology until you're in sixth form. So to me, the whole education system is not geared around the way that people work, but that's a rant for another time.
No, I absolutely agree, and I bet not often that can of worms either.
I imagine, because some of those ones are so, I'd imagine from a point of view that they're quite quantifiable, like you can pass a math test paper. Yep. If they get 1+1 wrong, you can be quite definitive in saying it's wrong. I imagine some of these, again, I don't like the term soft skills either, because it kind of...
I learned a new word for it. Impact skills is... and I liked it a lot. Skills that have impact on beyond the task itself.
Yeah.
I loved it.
No, that's really interesting that you say that, because I was thinking about how we measure these skills, and there's a thing called Kirkpatrick's framework for measuring training evaluation, but I think that that's been around for donkey's years. And I was talking to somebody at Cranfield where I used to work, and they are now looking at measuring impact rather than measuring learning from training, which I thought was massively interesting. And they've developed a framework for doing that. Unfortunately for me, it's proprietary, so I can't use it, but basically what they asked themselves is that as an educational establishment, do they deliver the impact that warrants the investments that clients make in learning and development? And I just thought that's a really interesting question. And does industry even understand how value is delivered through the work that we do? And I've just read that out from this particular booklet of theirs. I'll just run through a couple of things. You might find it quite interesting.
Yeah, please do.
They have categories of impact driver. So the first one is sort of about conversations and communications. So what is it that you learned in the educational program that means that you can go back to the workplace and have conversations develop as a consequence of what's been learned? So the way that they communicate outside of the program changes. So therefore, you're making a bigger impact in your workplace because you've learned how to communicate differently. But sense making, people learn something new. They go back and they can then solve organizational level challenges because they've learned to look at things from a different perspective and they can make sense of it in a way they never did before. Relationships, we've already talked about this. It's about building different relationships in the workplace that can have a massive impact on performance. Alignment, changing priorities following, having been on a training course and actually being able to align what you do to the organization's overall goals. So that is going to make a big impact in the way that you engage with your role and the work that you do. Engagement, that's another one. And capability, you can, their participants linked their changing capability to performance benefits within the organization. So everything is starting to look at the impact that training has, not I've learned something through knowledge and I can apply it and I can say it by rote, because you can and a lot of things like that, but having that doesn't necessarily mean you transfer it. So I was really keen to see what they've been doing on this measuring impact, because I think that that's the way that evaluation is going to go, because it takes away the problem of I can measure a task that you've taught me, but I can't measure decision making because you don't know what went on in my head. You don't know the process that I've got to get to that decision. And even when you've made the decision, you can't necessarily know that it was a good or a bad decision until many months down the line. So therefore, it makes it really difficult to measure. But I think if you start to look at impact in the business, that could be, it's going to be an interesting area of research going forward. And I'm keeping an eye on that to see where it's going to go, because I think it could be the answer to the problems we have with measuring workplace learning.
I think that's, people always say, oh, well, one of the challenges you have as a cybersecurity professional, Leanne, is keeping up. Yeah, keeping up is very difficult, but actually can't even measure that, really. I think the whole question around measurement in cybersecurity is a minefield, and I've seen very few instances where we've managed to crack it. So throughout my cybersecurity career, just had reports under my nose. Okay, we've our controls have stopped these many attacks, these many let in, for example, and 500 people have done the security awareness training in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah,
but then so what?
Yeah,
the so what piece.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's really, really difficult. And it's the so what piece of, so what for the teams themselves, the cybersecurity practitioners, like, what do you want, a pat on the back? Is that good? Is that bad?
Yeah.
And then the so what from the business going, yeah. So
I'd say, but some of that, unfortunately, I think is driven by a certain behaviour of, well, we from a compliance point of view, we need to have done this training annually, and that everybody new needs to have done it. And people go, rather than, this could be in anything, this could be in anti-money laundering, it could be in any kind of, back to the term mandatory training, any kind of training, is it just there to be a checkbox or not?
Pretty much. If what you're doing is putting a, you know, bums on seats, and were you there or weren't you? Did you complete it? Did you pass the, yes. Is there any way that you can then guarantee that transfer of training? Because there is no direct connection between a awareness and behaviour change. There is a model, behavioural intention. So basically what it says is you can make somebody aware of it, but in order for them to change it, there's a whole load of moderating variables in between that. And that's going to be based on the context, their values they've been brought up with, what their friends think. It might well be what their peers think. You know, you behave differently at work as you do at home. There'll be certain things that we do and comply with at work because we have to, because work gives us money to pay for our homes. But we wouldn't dream of doing something like that outside. So it's just recognizing that awareness is never going to equal a change in behavior because there's too many things happen in the way. Therefore, if awareness is done at several different levels in several different ways, you've got a better chance of it sinking in. So awareness training, for example, is one thing. Then you've got the posters around the office, which is slightly old-fashioned now. If you look at it from many different ways of doing it, you're more likely to get more compliance because there's the people who absolutely will not do it because they hate it. There's the people that love it and do it and really truly believe in it, and there's everything in between. So you've got to try and pick up on all of those different attitudes towards it, which again makes it more complicated because then we go down the route of one size doesn't fit all. Again, it's circular, isn't it? We just keep ending back in the same place.
It just reminds me of those adverts, which I'm sure you remember because they've become a bit of a meme. Copyright, and when it comes to things like software, and I think it was actually about movies, like you wouldn't steal a car, you wouldn't steal an X, and like,
yeah.
Well, it made people aware, but did it really change any behaviour other than the fact that people like to laugh about it as kind of a meme later on?
It might make you remember it. You might not do anything about it, but that's the only thing that you can hope is it made you laugh, so it sticks in your mind. But that's better than me doing my fire extinguisher training at Cranfield, where it didn't even make it through to switching down the computer at the end of after the session. So,
but again, what would have made it a more effective campaign? That one in particular. You know, it's about pirating films, isn't it, online, that advert, would be actually maybe the key grip who works on that film. They couldn't hire one. He lost out, wasn't able to make any money. That kind of emotive story instead would have been effective. Like every time you do this, you are impacting the industry. You know, we have to cut corners somewhere. We're cutting corners at the human element. I was going to ask, you said to me in one of our pre-discussions, don't measure things just because you can. And you mentioned that in terms of you need to identify value and business impact. What do you mean by don't measure things just because you can?
You can't. Well, I think we've kind of already sort of skirted around it, is that you can comply with regulation by saying you've trained everybody, but have you trained everybody? Or did you just have them there and they've completed the training? It's measuring the easy things. So it's easy to measure knowledge because you either know things or you don't. You know, like I talked about the law of armed conflict, and certainly there'll be a whole bunch of stuff that is knowledge-based and you can measure it. You can't necessarily measure somebody's attitude towards something. I mean, you can have attitude surveys, but that's going to depend on them filling it in. You can measure what's directly observable and that we can understand, and it's easy. But is it actually going to measure the impact that it has on the business? The model I mentioned earlier, the Kirkpatrick model, which is the one I was taught when I did my training, has four different levels. So level one is reaction, the happy sheet. Did people find it engaging? Was it relevant to them? Did they enjoy the lunch? Was the room the right temperature? You know, those sort of standard forms that you fill in at the end. Mm-hmm. We used to fill in at the end of a training course. Then the other thing that you've been measured is the learning. So that's that test. You know, you take a test before, you take it afterwards, you see an improvement in scores. We love that because then we can directly show that that training made me know more, therefore it was worth the spend. But you might have learned something, but did that change behaviour? So that's the degree to which the people who are on that training course actually change, apply what they learned when they get back to on the job. So again, if it's observable, if we can see, do you shut the fire door every time you go through it because you know, it's a fire hazard. Yes, I do, because the door's open or shut. Have I changed my mind about equality and diversity? You're never going to know, because what are you going to do? Measure my behaviour? How do you do that with everybody? How do you actually prove that happened? Same, exactly the same applies to cybersecurity awareness training. You've trained all this stuff. How do I get back? Oh, let's do a phishing thing. But there could be a million and one reasons why that didn't particularly work. So you're never really sure that that training had that effect. And then you've got level four of the model, which is what outcomes occurred as a result of the training. So have you actually had less cyber incidents as a result of all of this training? Well, do we know that? Is that measurement ever brought into the equation? Or does it stop with, we train the people, they're still doing the bad thing?
I would love to think that there's cyber criminals all over the world going, oh no, have you heard about Company X's security awareness training? We better not go there. They're really well trained and avoid them.
Yeah, I'd be very surprised if that happened, because I'd quite like it if it did. We all know that, I don't know, it's easy to focus on things that are obvious and are there in front of you. It's not so easy to dig around into the problem. And I think that's another, it's another natural thing that we do as part of this, the way that the brain works, those heuristics, is that actually we try and find a solution. What we don't do is stay in the problem space and dig around in that to actually find out what's causing it. We just go and apply a solution that we think might be, that we think is sensible, which goes back to that user-centered design thing. We don't know what other people do for their jobs. We think they do, but we don't know what it's like until you've actually had the experience of working in that role. I've also been at the coal face, but that's quite an old-fashioned way of talking now, isn't it?
I say nowadays being at the code face.
The code face. Oh, I like that. Oh, yes, thank you. I should write that down.
And I do wonder, though, if the way cybersecurity arranges its metrics is because of the context of the business overall. So unless you actually work in a cybersecurity company, you know, you are just a small element of this business. Mm-hmm. You're not part of usually a revenue-generating team. You're not usually, I would argue, there is definitely occasions where cybersecurity teams are definitely valuable and part of that value offering. And Jeff and I have done talks on that very thing. However, traditionally, not seeing as either value adding, if we think of it in the terms of tech, about software development, you know, building things to create value for their customers that will be revenue generating. We don't really do that, but we're still tested on very similar metrics of value driven. Like, did you finish that project? Well, no cybersecurity project ever finishes. That's probably why there's so much burnout in this industry. And the other thing is you can't test what you don't know what happened, because obviously the outcomes are, again, led by humans, they're led by cyber criminals usually. And how on earth are you going to predict if your interventions prevented anything? They might have just gone for a different target. It's very much a numbers game. Yeah. Were you unlucky enough to be in someone's sights that day? And how do you even test against that?
Well, and you can't, and that's it. Because we can't prove it. Any psychologist will tell you they hate the word prove, because we don't ever prove anything where human behaviour is concerned. You can have results and data that supports your theory or it doesn't support it, but you never prove anything. And I think that if you think about the way that we all were at school, you know, you pass things, you get certificates and things, you go to university, you do the same, you do your cybersecurity certifications, you're doing the same thing again. The way that the whole education system is set up throughout our whole lives is about proof that you can do something. And that is all about knowledge, observable knowledge. The philosophical underpinning is behaviourism. And it came around in the 50s. All of our education system is built on it. Everything in the military education system is purely built on it. We measure things that we can observe. And yet we know through later philosophies about constructivism, the way that I've been talking about adults learn, we build knowledge in our brains, we go and try it out, we learn by mistakes. That's never moved into the education system. So we're really, everything that we do is based on a system that's been around for 50 plus years, 70 years. I'm forgetting how far into the 2000s we are now. So we know it's an automatic thing. If you can measure it, you can prove it works. If you can't measure it, you can't prove it works. Therefore, it's not worth anything. So it's about challenging those years and years old assumptions about how we go about measuring things that needs to change. I've been talking about it for 20 years. I haven't seen any much of a shift in change of direction yet. But yeah,
it's... No, but I'm sure your research is contributing to that needle moving forward, even if it is incrementally. And I don't think it's you. I think it's not just change little C, is it? It's changing mindsets. It's changing the way business is run. It's changing the way one team gets budget and another team doesn't. It's a huge
change. It's a culture change. Yeah. Moves at the speed of a glacier. Yeah.
It does feel like some of it is like effectively they're trying to use a quantitative kind of measurement for something that's qualitative at best.
Yes, exactly that. And it's a natural go-to position. It's very few people actually challenge that. And I certainly didn't challenge it until I went and did my master's degree and learned that there's other ways of looking at the world. So, you know, it is what it is. But quantitative is always valued over qualitative.
Yeah, and I think that's such a shame because there's a potential to learn so much more in the grey areas, which is the human psyche is just full of grey areas and things.
Yeah.
Final question for you. So your business is all about focusing uniquely on the cybersecurity teams themselves, that a nice bit of introspection. What does that look like? So, well, firstly, when people come and hire your services, what are they after and how do you get them to where they need to be?
I think what they're after is the difficult one because people don't necessarily know what they need. They know they have a problem, but how to solve it is a different thing. And I think what they actually want is to have confidence that their teams can step up when the time happens, because it will happen. That's kind of well known now, I think. And also to know that not only can they step up in terms of the way that they react to it, but they step up together as a team. Because one thing that does happen a lot when people are under pressure is there's conflict, always. There's always frictions. That itself can get in the way and hinder any sort of response. Because if you've got people arguing amongst themselves because they've got different views on what needs to happen and when and why, then that's wasting time. That's not an effective response. So what they're looking for is to have confidence that their team can step up, can do it together as a team. They'll act resilient, you know, they'll have resilience as a team then, and you'll have a far more effective response and a quicker response, and you'll also be able to recover more quickly afterwards. So it's about solving a problem rather than looking for a particular outcome, if that makes sense.
Amazing. So obviously the suggestion is hire your services, but for our listeners, what could they do tomorrow to start thinking about making those relationships better?
Right. Okay. It's about people spending time with each other and listening to each other. So for me, if I were to get, I mean, a crisis response team generally is going to have different people from different departments. Tabletop exercise is actually a great way to start the conversations, as long as you're not just going through the process of doing the exercise. Because what I found in Immersive Labs when we were watching these things with the crisis sim is that you start to have arguments in the room. Somebody wants to do it one way, somebody else wants to do it a different way. And it's very easy to get caught up in arguing and trying to push for your way forward. What you need to do is just stop at that point and think, right, okay, so why do you want to do it that way? What's your story? What makes it that so important to you? And if each person can talk about that, they'll start to understand each other. You might not agree, but at least then you'll understand, well, actually, they've got a viewpoint that the business needs to carry on running, for example, whereas IT might want to just shut it down because they know that's the safest way to stop this thing. Let those conversations happen in a safe space when you've got time and you're not under pressure, because then that's all out the way. When the chips are down, you can just get on with your job and you kind of know when you've got to give and compromise because somebody else's priorities make more sense in that particular context. So yeah, talk to each other, listen to the detractors, listen to the people that don't think the same as you, and just try and understand where they're coming from. Ask the why question.
Absolutely. And one thing I've had quite good success at when I've done tabletops is I remember doing my first tabletop, and then when I was really early on, you know, it was just one of those tasks they gave like the newbie person to do, like run a tabletop for us. And I'd not had much experience with the exec team, and oh boy, that was an experience. Very opinionated, and I guess that's why they do the jobs they do. I did learn from that instantly. So the next time I did a tabletop exercise, you could tell any kind of, so you'd put a prompt and say, okay, what we're going to do? Do we pay the ransom, for example? And then everyone would look to the CEO and go,
yeah,
what's their response going to be? And then that would lead the conversation. And so you wouldn't understand actually, what do people really think? So I started doing things like, I can't remember what the equivalent was when I started doing it, using things like Slido and Mentimeter to actually, the prompt would be, you vote on it, but you don't see who's voting. It'd be an anonymous voting. Yeah. And so it'd be like, is it a yes or a no answer? And you go, okay, like seven people said yes. And what that was really good for was enabling people to have that psychological safety because it was anonymous, to be able to actually say what they really think. And then it led to like, what is the, if we're all going to be in agreement here, it was almost like 12 angry men. Let's come to an agreement with the jury and work through this. And I thought that was really useful to be able to build some psychological safety. And then it was just such a small tweak, had such great returns.
Massive impact. Yeah. Impact again, isn't it really? Mm. I used to love watching those things because for me, it was fascinating to not have to worry about the tech side of things, but you can see the different behaviours in the room and you can see when things are starting to go off track and that sort of thing. It's utterly fabulous. And I think that if it's done in such a way that there's, you know, even if you stop halfway through and have a think about where we are now, what's happened so far, are we happy with what we've done? It's not just dashing through it to get to the end of the exercise because we're trying to do it under pressure. It's about what are you learning from that. And the other thing that I learned with the military was they call it after action review, debrief, call it whatever you like. But if you do a structured debrief along a timeline from start to finish, what was supposed to happen, what actually happened, what did we do well, what did we do badly, and you actually go and implement those in the next tabletop exercise, that's a beautiful way of learning. Absolutely beautiful. The worst thing you can do is do an after action review, have a report and leave it on your hard drive somewhere never to be seen again.
I guess that if you're doing an after action review and then putting it and feeding in, is that effectively a way of doing reflective learning?
Yes, it is. It's group reflective learning, if you like. And I actually did a piece of research and I looked at what the British, the Canadian and the US armies did along these sort of lines, and it was really interesting. But some of them, at the time I did it, a dusty folder on a shelf somewhere. But what the real learning is to implement the learning from that. The triple loop learning is to go and look at the processes and put the processes right so the mistake can't happen again. So it's like lots of little loops of learning, if you like. So the first one is lessons identified. Second one is lessons learned, so you do something about them. And the third one is going back and thinking, actually, let's look a bit further back at the system and the processes. How did that occur in the first place? What can the organisation learn from that and implement to stop it happening again? But I think, generally speaking, after something like this, everybody's utterly exhausted and you don't even want to think about it. You just want to go home and go to sleep and be thankful it's all over.
And I think that's even the case for tabletop simulations. I've felt spent after them. Mm. And I think that's a good thing to actually, even though you know it's a simulation, to still have that adrenaline kick in.
Yeah, you've engaged with it. If you come out feeling shattered, yeah, you've engaged with it. So you will have learned something. And nobody says you have to do the debrief immediately. Sometimes it's helpful. Military do it so they do what they call a hot wash. So they'll do a quick wash up afterwards. And then later on, there'll be a proper debrief, but people come back, you know, you've had something to eat, you've slept over the weekend, you've had a chance to let thoughts settle and, you know, think about it in a less emotional way, and you can see things in a different light. That can also be very, very handy as a learning tool. You know, you don't do it when you're really tired. I mean, military have no choice because they're in the middle of nowhere doing, you know, things that don't necessarily stick to your average working week, but there's no reason why you can't go back, you know, quick wash up at the time, then go back and think about it when people have got the energy and the inclination.
Absolutely. I think there's been so much in this discussion that our listeners will be able to take away. I keep wanting to say readers. I don't know why I do. There is no transcript. Maybe one day when we can get a sponsorship, because those transcribing tools are really expensive. Thank you so much, Beck, for coming in and giving us your insights. You've definitely given me food for thought, and I'm very looking forward to when this episode airs to throw this at my team and say, like, this is how we're going to do tabletop simulations going forward.
Yeah, no, I've really enjoyed the conversation. I always do enjoy these types of conversations because I think there's so much that I have to learn about cybersecurity, and there's so much that I have learned about psychology to pass on. I think, as we said right at the start, it's that sort of meeting of two subject matter experts and working together to facilitate each other's understanding, and that to me is just wonderful, and I think there's a lot of learning to be had from that. So thank you very much for inviting me.
Where can people find you to tell us more, where can find about your business? I'm sure people will be clamoring to utilize your services.
Yep. You can find me on LinkedIn. I also have a website, which is mindscienceltd.co.uk, and there's a little bit of information on there about this agile thinking that I bang on about quite a lot. So yeah, you can find me quite easily in either of those two places.
Wonderful. Beck does a lot of podcasts herself. I've seen YouTube videos. I'll put in the show notes anything that our listeners will find of use based around this topic as well in there.
Thank you. As well as all your socials
as well.
Yes, thank it's you. All on LinkedIn. I tend to put it on there because it keeps it all in one place. It's a bit hard to keep track of otherwise.
Definitely a lady to follow. Really, really interesting content.
Thank you very much.
Since I heard Beck say awareness does not equal behavioural change, I've been saying it to anybody who will listen and having it roll around in my head in a constant refrain.
Oh, me too. And I think it pretty much sums up why a lot of security awareness programmes are, at best, just boring compliance tick boxes. Or at worst, like Damien said in a few episodes back, silly or annoying.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said also about how we measure things. or really what we can't measure, more like.
Which is just as an important consideration, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And the challenge in measuring things like behavioural change in turn makes it more difficult for cybersecurity teams to prove themselves or even justify the work they're doing inside the organisation.
And that's coming from someone like Beck, who's trained to quantify or qualify human behaviour. So if a trained specialist is saying that it's tough, what hope does your average cybersecurity professional have?
Well, I guess if they follow some of the key takeaways in this episode from Beck, they're probably off to a good start.
Absolutely. Right, now time for a hot wash on this episode and see what we've learned and what we can improve on.
Sounds good to me. Links to everything Beck discussed in this episode can be found in the show notes. And if you like the show, please do leave us a review and a share on LinkedIn or in your teams. It really helps us spread the word and get high quality guests like Beck on in future episodes. And don't forget to subscribe on the platform you're listening to. That small act means the world to us and also means you'll never miss an episode.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. See you next time. Keep secure and don't forget to ask yourself, am I the compromising position here?